Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. News.
Czech Republic lacks sufficient green financial and tax incentives, according to a new audit. Czech diplomats are hosting annual Mitterrand breakfast meetings with human rights activists. And Prague is to sign a Free Cities Pact with Budapest, Bratislava, and Warsaw. The Czech Republic lacks effective tax incentives and other measures to encourage cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, according to the Supreme Audit Office in a new report. The state has, for example, failed to motivate citizens to use greener energy sources and vehicles or reduce energy consumption, the auditors say. Unlike in most EU countries, financial measures aimed at combating global warming are not effectively enforced here, it claims. Foreign Minister Tomáš Petříček and Czech ambassadors worldwide this week are hosting breakfast meetings with foreign human rights and democracy campaigners. The meetings commemorate a famous breakfast over 30 years ago at Prague's embassy, when the French President François Mitterrand held talks with Czechoslovak dissidents in a significant gesture of support. His efforts helped spur the communist regime to grant official permission for a rally to be held on Human Rights Day on December the 10th, 1988, in Prague's Žižkov district. Prague City Hall councillors have agreed to conclude a Free Cities Pact with the other Visegrad IV group capitals aimed at strengthening cooperation. The mayors of Prague, Budapest, Bratislava, and Warsaw agreed to create the pact ahead of the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. The Free Cities Pact calls on signatories to work together to tackle climate change, housing and social policy issues, as well as to promote democratic ideals such as human rights and the rule of law. The pact is due to be signed on December the 16th in Budapest. Some 20,000 people have seen the Venus of Vjestonice since the statuette of a shapely old Stone Age woman went back on display 2 weeks ago after a 5-year hiatus. The Czech Venus is among the world's oldest ceramic pieces of art dating back nearly 30,000 years. Long queues to see the statuette have formed at the Regional Museum of Olomouc. The ceramic figure was discovered in Moravia in July 1925 among remnants of a prehistoric fire pit once used by mammoth hunters. Despite an anticipated slowdown in Czech economic growth, a record 59% of companies plan to pay employees a so-called 13th salary bonus this year. According to a survey by the Czech Chamber of Commerce, about three-quarters of big companies and nearly every second small one plan to pay out such Christmas bonuses. By comparison, in 2017, fewer than one in three big companies and one in five small ones paid out the 13th salary. The oldest living Czech citizen has died at the age of 108 in the Moravian town of Kroměříž. Born in 1911, Magdalena Kitnerová experienced the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, birth of an independent Czechoslovakia, two world wars, 40 years of communist rule, and 30 years of restored democracy. She attributed her longevity to eating, drinking, and doing as she pleased. There are now over 430 centenarians living in the Czech Republic, most of them women, and their numbers keep increasing. And finally, the weather. Tuesday should be partly cloudy nationwide during the day, with skies clearing in the evening. Average daytime highs are expected to range between 6 to 10 degrees Celsius. I'm Brent Kennedy, and that's the news for now. Hello and welcome. You are tuned to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Public Radio. I'm Brian Kennedy. Coming up in today's program, the upstart Tricolor Party of Václav Klaus Jr. is making inroads among voters by challenging elites. A greatly expanded online Holocaust archive offers details on the fates of Nazi victims, including many notable Czech figures. And we talked to Czech surgeon Bohdan Pomahač, who led the team that carried out the first full human transplant of a human face in the United States. All those stories coming up shortly, so please do stay with us. A new Kantar CZ opinion poll suggests that the Tricolor Party of Václav Klaus Jr. would take 6.5% of the vote in a general election. It is the first time such a survey has put the conservative grouping, which launched in June, above the 5% threshold needed to enter the Chamber of Deputies. Ian Willoughby talked to political scientist Peter Joost about which other parties were likely to be losing voters to the party.
Well, since the Tricolour identifies itself as a party challenging the elite, the elitistic system, it's a party challenging the liberal democratic system, it's a party that challenges all these NGOs and media, especially media of the public service, they will probably have a similar voter such as parties like Tomio Okamura's Freedom and Direct Democracy. And in general, I think this party will also attract any other voters who feel somehow disappointed, dissatisfied with the current development, who would use this party as a way to express their protest and their challenge against the system, which on the other hand is quite ironic because Mr. Klaus Jr. Is the son of Václav Klaus, the former prime minister and former president, who basically was very much co-responsible for building the system.
Both Tricolour and Freedom and Direct Democracy, the party of Tomio Okamura, are on 6.5% according to this new poll. Which of those parties do you think is most likely to make an impact at the next general elections or even beyond then?
Definitely from long-term perspective, we see that the Tricolour is slowly moving up. So it does not matter right now whether they have 5, 6 or 7%. What is clear is that there is a rising tendency. While in case of Mr. Okamura's party, we see either decline or a stable position around this 6-7% of support. So if I should use these inputs into my evaluation or into any conclusion, then I would say that the Tricolour is on a better trajectory than the Freedom and Direct Democracy.
What about the long-term aims of Tricolour? I've read that the party's ultimate aim may be to try to make Václav Klaus Jr. the next Czech president.
Many of the newly founded parties that are founded around some strong personality, they are sometimes understood also as building the base for a future presidential run. Whether the party becomes big or small in future actually makes no difference. That the party and the party structures in general are very important for creating some technical, administrative, financial, logistical and personal ground for running a presidential campaign. And basically the party nominees for presidential offices, they can use the advantages of political party structures. Václav Klaus Jr.'s name has been rumored several times among a possible and potential presidential candidates. And there would be no surprise if this would be one of the goals of the Tricolour Party.
Political scientist Peter Joost was speaking to our own Ian Willoughby. Hundreds of thousands of documents were recently added to the website of the Arolsen Archives Organization, which houses the world's most comprehensive collection on Nazi persecution. Not only do they offer new opportunities to find out what happened to victims, but they also provide details on some of the leading figures of 20th century Czechoslovakia. Tom McEncroe has the details.
The Nazi occupation of Bohemia and Moravia during the Second World War led to the incarceration and, in many cases, deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. The fate of many of these individuals still remains unclear, but those seeking to find out what happened to their relatives or friends can rely on a major new online data source in the form of the Arolsen Archives website, which contains some 14 million documents housed by the International Centre on Nazi Persecution. Just last month, some 850,000 new documents were uploaded, containing information on 10 million foreign nationals, German Jews and stateless people, collected in the winter of 1945-46 in Germany as a result of orders issued by the four occupying powers. These issued orders to German local authorities, companies and other institutions, requiring them to draw up lists of people who were registered with them. Many of these names are Czechoslovak, says Florian Azulej, the director of the Arolsen Archives.
We have many documents related to the former Czechoslovakia, but I cannot tell you how many we have. We have documents about incarceration and especially about Theresienstadt, but we also have documents about the after war, about survivors who were from the former Czechoslovakia and who were taken care of by the Allied forces and could emigrate after the war.
Among the new publicly accessible data are the death camp deportation cards of leading First Republic personalities such as Karel Poláček, Josef Čapek and Karel Ančero. The documents also contain details on figures that became influential in post-war Czechoslovakia. For example, a questionnaire where journalist and writer Pavel Tigrit states political reasons for his flight to the West and indicates his desire to emigrate to the US or Canada. Treasure troves of archives relating to the past century remain strewn across Central Europe, but are often difficult to access by non-native speakers. However, this should not be a problem for those seeking to explore the Arolzen archives, says Miss Azalea.
You don't need to speak German. The search engine is in English, and in future we intend to develop it in other languages as well, because there is a great interest from around the world.
It seems that more may yet come, as the Arolzen archives have said that documents from the British occupation zone will soon become available as well.
Tom McEncrow reporting. Just a reminder that you're listening to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio, where it's now time for our main feature, One-on-One with Ian Willoughby.
Bohdan Pomahač led the team that carried out the first ever full transplant of a human face in the United States. The Boston-based plastic surgeon recently received the Gracias Agate Award from the Czech Ministry of Foreign Affairs for promoting the good name of the Czech Republic abroad. After the ceremony, I spoke to the famous physician about various aspects of facial transplantation and much more. You were 18 in November 1989. Mm-hmm. Was that the ideal age to go through that experience?
I would say absolutely. We were sort of, even during the high school years, we were realizing that the communist system was kind of a joke. And a lot of the young communist activities that we had to participate in mandatorily were pretty much laughable matters. So 1989, when the change came, the hardest thing was to believe that this is real this time, that it's not another 1968. But the more the Velvet Revolution continued, the more it was apparent that this time it will happen, just like Germany, Hungary. We will set sort of a path forward in a democratic way. So I think being young and being able to participate in it was very, very special.
When you were studying medicine in Olomouc, you had a study stay in Boston. I guess that was a real turning point in your life.
The way it happened was our associate dean, Professor Dušek in Olomouc, was interested in introducing problem-based learning, a system of medical education that existed only at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, and Harvard Medical School. I happened to spend the summer in the United States. Professor Dušek found that out, and he asked me if I would be willing to participate for a week in a student experience, so that when I come back, I could provide feedback as a student for the new problem-based pathway that he was preparing. So that was my first exposure to Boston, and that's the first time I was impressed by number and size of the hospitals. And somewhat naively, I thought there'll be a room for one extra physician to get trained well.
And what led you to the area of plastic surgery?
That was sort of a coincidence. I always knew and actually entered medical school with the goal to become a surgeon, but I have changed what kind of surgery based on my experience throughout the school. And ultimately, even when I departed to the United States, I was sort of leaning towards transplant surgery or vascular surgery, but that's when I met Professor Olof Eriksson from plastic surgery, ended up working in his laboratory for 2 years, and ended up really getting exposed to plastic reconstructive surgery. And it was the reconstruction of face that absolutely fascinated me. And from then on, I just knew that that's the field I want to be in.
You famously led the team that carried out the first full transplant of a human face in the U.S. What were the advances that had allowed this to happen 10 years ago?
So there were quite a few. Evolution is sort of a spiral event. And in the 70s, Ian Taylor, New Zealander, Australian team with Wayne Morrison, came with the fundamental principles and proofs of being able to transfer tissues using microscope reconnecting vessels. So development of field of microsurgery was ultimately the first stepping stone. And then later on, it was probably the right environment where immunosuppressive medications were considered not as harmful, and the benefits for patients with major facial deformities seemed to be reasonable. So it all happened at the right time when I was starting in my practice that I saw the opportunity and felt that we should be able to provide these type of reconstructions for the patients in the greatest need.
It's still a very unusual procedure. How do you select the patients who receive it?
The selection process is rather long. We have actually overall had almost 100 patients that either called us or were referred by physicians, and only about 20 of them were seriously looked at. The other patients had either major medical issues, major socioeconomic issues, or just surgically there were other options than transplant. And out of the 20, we ended up selecting 10 or 11 that were actually listed for transplantation, and 8 of those we were able to transplant. A couple of patients actually changed their mind in the process and decided against it, even though they were deemed suitable candidates. The process includes evaluation of the patient's background, socioeconomic, medical understanding, but also their medical sort of overall well-being, comorbidities, and ultimately their surgical suitability as well. So it's a multidisciplinary team that looks at these patients and comes to conclusion.
And given that the first one was 10 years ago, you've been able to see the aging process. How do transplanted faces age?
Yeah, there's no question. We have had the oldest patient 10 years ago to the newest transplant 1 year ago, and there is definitely, without a doubt, change in each one of those that reflects in sort of loss of a little bit of a volume, a little bit of a change in the quality of skin. There probably is some sort of a chronic rejection process that occurs. And, you know, I've always been saying kidney transplants last half time is about 15 years, so we cannot expect that faces that were transplanted are going to last any longer. As a matter of fact, one would expect shorter half-life due to the high immunogenicity that the skin elicits in the body. So we're studying the processes, we're trying to learn from it, we're trying to figure out how to slow it down, stop it, reverse it, and it's a fascinating scientific endeavor.
But if somebody needed a second operation, would you amend their face that they've received or somehow give them a second new face?
Patient may lose a face probably in two different ways. One would be acute rejection that we cannot control, and this could lead to catastrophe with the face literally dying off. And that's a kind of more difficult scenario because we would have to probably use conventional techniques, but potentially down the line retransplant the patient. The other option is this chronic slow rejection where the quality of the tissues will be gradually changing. Probably the face would lose a lot of the functionality, and even the appearance may not be as nice and natural, but it would give us a time to work with the patient and decide, do we leave it as it is, or do we potentially consider retransplantation?
And what have your patients told you about how this surgery has changed their lives?
That's quite amazing. We have our first patient was able to come to graduation of his daughter from college. Later on, she got married, so he went to her wedding and led her down the aisle. He was grandfather of 2 children, and I don't think that it would be easy without a face with the horrendous deformity that he suffered. So I think he really had the best 10 years of his life after the transplantation. And it goes on and on. The second patient got married after the transplantation. So I think this social integration, the ability to interact, find romantic relationships, and be active in society has been the major benefits of the surgery.
You also perform regular plastic surgery. Does this work with face transplantation feel more important to you than, I don't know, a normal facelift or something like that?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, for me, the range of reconstruction of face starts from the most extreme, like transplant, and goes through major reconstructive efforts all the way to maybe cosmetic corrections of minor deformities. And it's all kind of, in my mind, one sort of continuum of surgical technique. So it's actually complementing what I'm doing on a usual and regular basis. And I think my practice is still mostly reconstructive, but I do perform about 30% of my practice is now aesthetic, and I think it definitely helps.
More generally, given your job, can you recognize people who've had plastic surgery? If you're on the tram, can you say, she's had her eyes done and he's got a new nose or whatever?
I can see the bad plastic surgery, but I'm not sure I would recognize, good plastic surgery should really not be that visible. Although if you know the patient or person well, then of course you would pick it up.
Do Czech doctors in the States have reputation for any particular trait or characteristic?
I think in general, Czechs in the United States are viewed as intelligent, hardworking people because most of the people that actually ended up in the United States and stayed there were those kind of people, hardworking, intelligent, and so forth. I think it's very, very, in general, a good name that Czechs have in the United States.
Do you get a lot of offers to come here to the Czech Republic to do surgery?
There have been a few. It's logistically incredibly complicated, and I have, you know, busy practice of my own booked in many months in advance, so it's sort of not very practical. But at the same time, I think that there are very skilled surgeons here that can do pretty much everything that I can. So I would be happy to help with advice, but may not be necessary that I would be flying all over just to do a case.
Is there anything that the Czech Republic could learn from the U.S. healthcare system?
I think the system of training is the best, postgraduate training after medical school is the best in the United States among all the countries that I've visited and seen in the world. So I think what we could learn is really how to give responsibilities to the physicians, how to develop training system, and how to gradually increase the responsibilities and sort of the difficulty of tasks and cases that young physicians would do so that they graduate comfortable and confident that they can do the whole range of their specialty.
Your wife is also Czech. How often do you come home, and what's your children's relationship to the Czech Republic?
So, yes, my wife, we met just before medical school. She's a physician as well, although she stayed with children at home when we moved to the United States. I would say that we have, in general, opportunity to come, me personally, twice a year. They generally come once a year, including the children, because, of course, our relatives live in the Czech Republic. And our daughter keeps telling us that one day she will live in the Czech Republic, so she has a very, very warm and nice relationship. She feels like she belongs to two countries rather than one. And our son, I think, in a similar fashion, can speak both the language as well as recognize the differences in culture, but also enjoys being sort of a citizen of two nations.
I guess in the States, most people wouldn't recognize you. Here in the Czech Republic, many people do. Is that something that's strange when you get off the plane and suddenly you're a celebrity?
People are very nice, and it's actually, if anything, it's only pleasant that somebody wants to shake your hand or thank you for giving the Czech Republic a good name abroad. So it's very pleasant, and I'm very honored and humbled that people perhaps recognize my name or face.
And Ian Willoughby was speaking to Czech surgeon Bohdan Pomahac in that edition of One on One, which first aired in June. And that brings us to the end of our program. If you tuned in late, not to worry. The full broadcast is available on our webpage. That's at radio.cz. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and invite you to follow us there. If you have any questions or comments, please do get in touch. Our email address is english@radio.cz. Meanwhile, for me, Brian Kennedy, and the rest of the Radio Prague International team, thanks for listening, and goodbye for now.